I think Alaskans need to accept we're just not going to get filthy, stinking rich off gas like we did oil.
The federal gas line coordinator delivers a message to lawmakers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 17th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a cultural exchange program in Sitka to connect Tlingit and Aleutic teenagers to their history.
It's not something you read about in a book. It's something that's real and continues to exist, and it gets them excited about their past and about the present.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
An Anchorage woman has been accused of suffocating her three-week-old infant daughter with a plastic bag. 33-year-old Sarah Bentley Johnson has been charged with first-degree murder in the infant's August 5th death. She made her first court appearance in Anchorage today. According to the Anchorage Daily News, Johnson told family members she had been feeling overwhelmed since the baby was born and confessed to killing her daughter. Johnson initially told police the girl died in her sleep. She was arrested on Tuesday. A workman died this afternoon in an accident at the port of Anchorage. The city's fire department responded to an emergency call after a bulldozer fell into the water at a construction site at the north end of the port. Rescue crews found the man was pinned beneath the bulldozer. The fire department confirmed the death. Officials used heavy equipment to lift the bulldozer off the man. The state Senate committee looking at the state's energy future today got a reminder from the federal pipeline coordinator. The state statute setting up a pipeline project from the North Slope to North American markets will not by itself bring about a gas line, APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
It's going to take some more work back home. Federal pipeline coordinator Larry Pursley said the final decisions on a high-volume gas line will be made by stakeholders in the private sector, and their decisions will be based on market economics. Discussing AGIA, the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act that the legislature approved in 2007, Pursley updated the Senate Resources Committee on the project's permits, along with the engineering and design work that's taken place. However, he said, those are the easy parts of the project.
It's the politics and the market economics that are the problems on this project, I believe. I guess to address AGIA, since that seems to be an issue on a lot of people's minds, and these, of course, are my opinion, AGIA was never going to get you a pipeline unto itself. I think it was oversold, a little misunderstood, mistaken, misleading, pick your word, but AGIA is a path toward getting a building permit for a pipeline.
Pursley said the state AGIA statute does not deal with financing or with fiscal conditions that need to be settled before anyone will be willing to make long-term commitments to use the line. And he said those issues need to be discussed with potential shippers. He also suggested that Alaskans' expectations of wealth from taking gas to market is a destructive burden on the project.
I think Alaskans need to accept we're just not going to get filthy, stinking rich off gas like we did oil. The money just isn't there. We can still be wealthy. We can still have a great future. But the expectations have to match economic reality.
Pursley says exploring for marketable reserves of gas will also help increase oil production, which is more profitable. It'll also produce more revenue, and it will produce natural gas energy for Alaskans to use for themselves. He said it's in the state's hands to make the project viable, to negotiate terms that will give value to the work going on now. Questioning the next step, Anchorage Republican Mike Hawker said he aligned himself with Pursley.
We don't have a viable project in front of us today, and we probably won't until we sit down and negotiate with the producers, bring everyone to the table, and start, you know, working on coming up with some alignment. And is the fiscal regime the single greatest negotiation we should be having with the producers, in your opinion?
Pursley agreed. saying the tax structure is the only thing over which the state has any control that could put the project over its economic hurdle and convince producers to make their needed commitments. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The Alaska Air National Guard was able to locate and rescue a man who crashed his plane near Valdez overnight. As KCHU's Tony Gorman reports, rescue crews arrived on scene to find the man okay.
According to the Alaska Air National Guard, the Piper PA-18 went down 14 nautical miles southeast of Valdez late Tuesday night. The pilot of the aircraft later activated his spot locator beacon. Alaska Air National Guard spokeswoman Kalei Rupp says the signal was received by a member of the Valdez Civil Air Patrol at 10:45.
That person then contacted the 11th Rescue Coordination Center. So once our 11th Air Force Rescue Coordination Center received word that someone was in need of assistance, we tasked our Alaska Air National Guard 210th, 211th, and 212th Rescue Squadrons to respond to this distress call.
An HH-60 Pave Hawk helicopter and an HC-130 Hercules jet carrying Guardian Angels were launched approximately at 1:05 Wednesday morning. Rupp says rescue crews quickly located the pilot and the aircraft.
He was uninjured, but he was stranded because of the condition of his plane. So our rescue crews loaded him onto the Pave Hawk helicopter and took him to Valdez, where he was turned over to local law enforcement there.
The name of the pilot was not released. The points of origin and destination are unknown at this time. Rupp says the National Transportation Safety Board will be investigating the cause of the crash. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
Exploratory drilling at two southeast Alaska mines can go forward in roadless areas of the Tongass National Forest. U.S. Forest Service Chief Tom Tidwell yesterday approved up to three drilling sites at the Greens Creek Mine within the Admiralty Island National Monument. Tidwell has allowed eight drilling projects at the Niblack on Prince of Wales Island. Drilling at each mine site will total less than an acre. Helicopters will move equipment to and from the sites. Alaska Regional Forester Beth Pendleton says no roads will be built and reclamation will follow drilling operations.
They would be permitted then to go in and actually construct the drilling pad sites and then proceed with geotechnical and exploration drilling at those sites.
Greens Creek is owned by Idaho-based Hecla Mining Company. Niblack is a mineral prospect being developed by Heatherdale Resources based in Vancouver, British Columbia. Drilling will help determine the extent and makeup of the mineral deposits. Pendleton says both will create new mining jobs in Southeast. Greens Creek and Niblack were part of a recent federal court agreement listing mine, hydropower, and other projects that would be allowed in roadless areas of the Tongass. An earlier court decision imposed the nationwide roadless rule in Alaska after years of exemptions. The state of Alaska in June appealed the ruling. A group of Southeast organizations and businesses say they will prohibit renewable energy, mining, and timber projects. The group plans to file on Friday as interveners in the state's legal challenge. But conservation groups say the drilling project approval indicates the flexibility of the roadless rule. Buck Lindekugel is an attorney with the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council.
If you read the rule does not prohibit mining in roadless areas. It does not prohibit renewable energy development. And the court made that very clear when it issued its proposed order. And the reason we listed the projects in that proposed order was to clarify the flexibility in the rule.
SEAC and the Forest Service helped negotiate the list approved in May by U.S. District Court Judge John Sedgwick. The order states that development is not limited to the specified projects. Lindekugel calls the intervener's argument a lot of scare tactics. The group includes the Juneau Chamber of Commerce, mining associations, and several energy and shipping companies. The Forest Service earlier this month approved tree clearing for two other Southeast exploration projects, Wuwatski Island, south of Petersburg, and Bokan Mountain on Prince of Wales Island. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a major gift will help UAF keep its mining program.
Many of the mining programs around the country shut down. There's only 13 accredited mining programs around the country, and we are one of them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
The moose hunting season begins in just a few weeks for residents of the lower Kuskokwim River. This season, hunters will have a better chance of killing a moose than in previous years. That's because wildlife managers are bumping up the harvest quota. The move comes after a surprising study on the Kuskokwim moose population. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
For 5 years, hunters along the subsistence-heavy Kuskokwim region put themselves under a moose moratorium in hopes that the population could recover. It did, and in 2009, when hunters were able to go after bulls, they proved a bit overzealous. They reported killing well over the quota set by the Department of Fish and Game. A year later, a tighter quota was put in place by Fish and Wildlife. It was more conservative, and after just 7 days, managers closed the hunt by emergency order. When the numbers were crunched, hunters had done it again, killing well over the established quota. So biologists with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had a few concerns before they began an aerial survey last fall. But according to biologist Tom Doolittle, what they found was a 37% increase in the total population from just the previous year.
That was a relief to managers and also why we felt that we could have a slight increase.
That's prompted Fish and Wildlife to increase the harvest quota from 75 moose last year up to 100 this year. Doolittle says surveyors flying over the Kuskokwim counted 356 moose on a 10.5-hour flight. That's about 100 more than the same flight the year before. Doolittle says biologists were pleased not just with the overall count, but also the mix of adults. The worst fear was that hunters could have overharvested bulls, which would have slowed down the reproductive rates for the future. Those fears were grounded in a previous aerial survey. After that first Kuskokwim hunt, the bull-to-cow ratio was cut in half. A similar drop after the next year's hunt could have stunted growth dramatically.
The bull-to-cow ratio, though, was very good and unchanged from last year.
And that means the current ratio, as viewed by biologists, is close to ideal. That, combined with an estimated population of 960 moose in the lower Kuskokwim area, is leading biologists to one simple conclusion.
Even with harvest, we are seeing a substantial increase in the lower Kuskokwim drainage moose population.
But biologists still believe there's further room to grow, so they will continue to implement quotas, especially considering that Bethel, the largest city in western Alaska, is home to scores of hunters, and the Kuskokwim River is the most populous region in western Alaska, with over 13 villages in the hunt area. Last year, over 1,500 hunters received permits to go after those 75 moose. The lower Kuskokwim opens up September 1st on both state and federal lands. The hunt on state land is open to any Alaskan hunter, but they must apply for a permit in the area. Fish and Wildlife says in the future, they hope the harvest quota increases along with the Kuskokwim moose population. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
A group of students from Sitka are in Kodiak this week for the second half of an exchange with the Woody Island Tribe. Like many exchange programs, this one aims to foster better understanding between two cultures, but it also could help preserve traditions lost to either side and foster healing between two cultures with a difficult history. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
A group of students from Sitka is walking down the trail at Sitka National Historical Park, learning about the totem poles that line it. They're preparing for a visit to Kodiak as part of a cultural exchange program run by the park. Becky Latonich is chief of interpretation and education at the park. She says sending the Tlingit youth to Kodiak is the second half of the exchange program, which began last summer.
The first year when they came over, the Kodiak people, who are Aleutic or Aleut or Sukpiak, came here to learn about a series of dances called the Aleut series or the Aleutic series that was over time lost to them but preserved in the Tlingit culture.
This year, the Tlingit students will learn more about their relationship with Kodiak. Latonich says there are some Tlingit sites there, and the trip will offer a way for them to learn about that history. She says all of it, the history and the dancing, is an effective way to preserve and further Native culture and tradition.
It was What's so neat is the youth involvement in the dance, because it's the youth who are performing the dance. It's not just something that's locked away in the elders' memories. It's something that they practice, that the dancers are engaged in. We just had an evening program last Thursday where the students performed the Aleut series for their practice, and more than anything, you could tell that they enjoyed doing it. It was really fun, and I hope they bring not just the tradition back to Kodiak, but that they bring that sense of enjoyment and excitement and engagement with culture back to Kodiak as well.
Latanich says it's one thing for the students to learn about cultural traditions, but immersing in those traditions is another thing entirely.
It's not something you read about in a book. It's something that's real and continues to exist, and it gets them excited about their past and about the present.
The trip is funded with a $15,000 grant from a program called America's Best Ideas.
And I think this is a very good idea.
Kathy Drabeck is the tribal administrator of the Woody Island Tribal Council.
Actually, we are Tongihanok Native Village.
She says the visit to Kodiak will include dinners and tours, but also a healing ceremony on Friday on a Fognak Island, which was the site of a battle between the Tlingit and the Aleutic people. Drabeck says the majority of Tlingits were killed in the battle.
Cries can still be heard in that location, and we're hoping that any animosity and spiritual disruption would be forgiven with the apology ceremony and prayers.
And she says giving students and elders the opportunity to engage in that kind of cultural sharing is hugely important.
The analysis of what about history matters to an individual culture and the similarities of different cultures interacting is, I just think that's productive for any society.
16-year-old Sitka resident Sabrina Gamble was part of the program last year. She says it was tough going at first, but that a transformation took place during the visit.
At first, everyone was just kind of, I don't know what I'm doing here, I don't want to be here, kind of awkward, being forced to do things. But by the end, everyone, well, all of them just didn't want to leave because we all connected so well and they were learning so much and they just wanted to keep on learning. It seemed like they wanted to keep on learning more about what we were teaching them.
Do you think that you'll have that experience when you're there?
I hope so. Because while they were here, we didn't get to learn anything really about their songs. I mean, they performed and stuff, but I think it'd be nice to actually have them teach us their songs.
The students will keep journals during their trip. Sitka National Historical Park is in the process of creating a Facebook page where the students will share their observations. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
We all need energy to power our homes and businesses. Tapping renewable energy sources like wind, geothermal, and hydro helps keep our economy local, creating jobs, revenue, and power for the state. Learn more at realaska.org. This message sponsored by Renewable Energy Alaska Project, committed to creating a sustainable economic future for Alaska. A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2011 PFD application with My PFD Info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until Wednesday, August 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks has received a major gift from private industry. Kinross Fort Knox Mine presented the UAF School of Mining and Geological Engineering a check for nearly $1 million yesterday. Kinross North America Vice President Lauren Roberts says the gift will fund a research endowment that's developed out of a partnership with UAF.
We have a long relationship with University of Alaska Fairbanks and the mining program. We employ quite a few graduates from the school. We conduct research activities with the school. And we viewed this as a way to make a long-term sustainable impact in that area and give something back to the university system.
The UAF Mining Program Endowment will fund graduate student research. Program Chair Rajiv Ganguly says that's important because university-level mining programs have dwindled nationwide since a major research funding source, the Federal Bureau of Mines, closed over a decade ago.
The very top level, it's very challenging because graduate education requires funding.
You know, you need to provide assistance ships. Research is expensive. And when the Bureau of Mines closed in 1995, you know, that funding source disappeared. And as a result of that, many of the mining programs around the country shut down. There's only 13 accredited mining programs around the country, and we are one of them.
The financial boost comes during a global boom in the industry, but Dean of the College of Engineering and Mines, Doug Goring, says mining also faces challenges.
In terms of economic sustainability, environmental impacts, all of those things I think are things that we'll be able to help provide new knowledge on as we move forward. And this endowment will really help us to carry that out.
The UAF mining program provides skilled workers for an industry in the midst of an employee shortage. Kinross's Roberts says his company alone needs to hire about 7,000 people for projects worldwide in the next 5 years. The Kinross Gift qualifies the company for state and federal tax credits under the Alaska Education Tax Credit Program. Fisheries officials got an earful at a meeting in Homer last week about the new proposed catch-sharing plan for South Central halibut fishermen. Local halibut charter captains are actively campaigning against the plan, saying it could cut the Homer fleet by a third. KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports.
Glenn Merrill is an administrator at NIMFS. He began the meeting by explaining the roles of various organizations in making decisions about halibut fisheries. It's up to the International Pacific Halibut Commission, he said, to make annual allocations of halibut, and it falls to the Federal North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, or the North Council, to set new policy. The North Council has been looking at possible new rules for halibut management in Alaska for 17 years, said Merrill, and has implemented some of them recently, including a one-fish rule in southeast Alaska. Merrill says the proposed catch-sharing plan for Area 2C, South Central Alaska, has been in the works for about 5 years.
The main aspects of what the catch-sharing plan would do is that it would annually implement this range that we try and manage the charter fleet to. And then there are a series of measures, management measures, that would go into place on an annual basis in order to retain the fleet within their overall limit.
Those measures include the possibility of limiting the size of fish that could be caught on charter vessels or reducing the bag limit from 2 fish to 1. The new plan also establishes annual allocations for the commercial halibut fleet, and it would allow for the annual transfer of commercial halibut quota to charter operators. One member of the audience disputed the assertion that halibut biomass has decreased over the years, and he predicted the new rules would not have the desired effect of increasing it.
It's not true that the charter fleet will go and catch fewer fish. They won't go.
One man said he spent $1,000 to come all the way from his home in Kentucky to fish the Kenai River and in Homer.
Then I get down here today and find out that you're looking at reducing the number of halibut to a person like me that can catch. Honestly, I can tell you this. If it's reduced to one, I'm not sure I'd ever come back to Alaska to fish, you know, again. And I like to fish.
Many people in the audience expressed concern that based on current halibut measurements, the new catch-sharing plan would simply mean a one-fish-per-customer rule for the foreseeable future. Merrill said that was an oversimplification and that the plan has, quote, a lot of moving parts. One thing that could happen, he said, is that stock abundance could go up and put the fleet in a higher tier than it would fall into right now.
Second thing that could happen is if there was a change in fleet behavior and there was less demand, then you could obviously, if you look at the projections going forward, and it looks like there's going to be not as much charter harvests in the coming year based on the projections that are made, then you also would have a less restrictive measure because it would look like you'd be under that.
Homer Charter Captain Scott Glosser summed up a lot of the comments from the audience during the two-hour meeting. He said the local fleet was united in its outrage at the new plan.
90% of the people on my boat had no clue that this was happening, and once they found out that it is happening, they are also outraged. So what that means is that there's hundreds of thousands of sport fishermen across the country that are also going to be outraged at this law. And it's going to come down on you pretty heavy and it's going to be a fight, and it's not over. Thanks.
The deadline for public comment on the new halibut catch-sharing plan is September 6th. After that, the plan will be discussed at the January annual meeting of the International Pacific Halibut Commission. It could become law in March of next year. In Homer, and with help from KBBI's Paulette Wellington, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Chicago police have recovered the equipment of the rock band Portugal the Man, which was stolen along with its touring van and trailer after an appearance at the Lollapalooza Music Festival. A mechanic, Juan Ocampo, was charged with felony theft after $80,000 worth of the band's equipment was found inside his apartment, including vintage guitars and amps, keyboards, effects pedals, drums, and microphones. Ocampo says he bought the gear at a flea market on Chicago's South Side. The band is based in Oregon, but originally from Wasilla, Alaska. And finally tonight, two corrections. The first one is for a story that aired last week about the invasive tunicate found in Sitka's Whiting Harbor. That report said Charlie Swanton, director of sport fish for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, told the Sitka Assembly on August 9th that the presence of the tunicate put a nearby oyster farm out of business. That is not correct. Responding to a question from the Assembly, Swanton did say he believes the oyster farm is out of business, but he did not say it was as a result of the invasive species in the harbor. And in a story yesterday, we reported that the Supreme Court of Alaska had granted a motion by the state of Alaska for emergency review of the case of the Pebble Partnership versus the Lake and Peninsula Borough. The Pebble Partnership had requested a review of the case, but the Supreme Court has yet to decide on that issue. However, the state did not request an emergency review of the case. Instead, the state requested an emergency review of their motion to participate in the case as a friend of the court. The Supreme Court did grant that motion. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tony Gorman in Valdez, Rosemary Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future, ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company,
and by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska, pebblepartnership.com. The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth. As a result, organizations often become stronger. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
You can find APRN headlines from around the state online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.